From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
There were women and children running for their lives, being shot at by a helicopter hovering over their homes. And these people were not Taliban supporters. They weren't Al-Qaeda fighters. They were simple Afghans trying to stay safe in their own country.
From one ground zero to another.
My brother died in the World Trade Center building. He was on the 27th floor.
Today, a New Yorker who lost her brother in the World Trade Center attacks and an Afghan-American woman who lost 19 members of her family in the U.S. bombing meet for the first time. And it's our second day back on Pacifica Airwaves as Pacifica stations WBAI, KPFK, and WPFW censor or refuse to air Democracy Now! We bring you highlights of the last few months, the voices Pacifica didn't let you hear. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal appeals court yesterday ordered a new trial for two African-American men who were convicted of civil rights violations in the fatal stabbing of a Hasidic Jew in Crown Heights, Brooklyn in 1991. The court ruled the judge in their 1997 trial had improperly manipulated jury selection and conducted a race and religion-based reshuffling of the jury that had denied the men a fair trial. The ruling marks another twist in a long and contentious case that was an outgrowth of one of the most bitter racial conflicts in New York City's history. President George W. Bush is becoming famous for his verbal blunders, grammatical mistakes, and inability to make a clear distinction between Slovenia and Slovakia. But this time, he's made remarks that are being called overtly racist. At the White House yesterday, Bush used the term Paki when speaking to reporters about the tense situation between India and Pakistan. The term is an ethnic slur toward Pakistanis. The White House defended Bush's use of the phrase, saying he meant no disrespect. The Pentagon announced it is wrapping up its search for Osama bin Laden at Tora Bora in Afghanistan. General Tommy Franks admitted for the first time yesterday the search had failed to turn up bin Laden. Franks also said an arrangement has been put in place that could lead to U.S. troops pursuing him in neighboring Pakistan. This comes as the Bush administration announced U.S. officials will stop making public speculations on the whereabouts of bin Laden. Newly declassified documents have revealed details on the extent of U.S. support for jailed Peruvian intelligence chief Vladimiro Montesinos. He was the right-hand man to the ex-dictator Alberto Fujimori and is now imprisoned on a wide range of corruption charges. Montesinos had worked extensively with the CIA and was the mastermind of widespread campaigns of state terror inside Peru. The documents show clearly U.S. officials were aware of Montesinos' involvement or alleged involvement in massacres and corruption, but continue to view him as the, quote, go-to guy and a close ally in the so-called war on drugs. Among the many accusations against Montesinos is that he accepted payoffs from a drug kingpin to use an airspace to ship cocaine out of the Peruvian jungle. According to weapons specialists inside and outside the government, the Bush administration is considering resuming underground nuclear testing. While the United States refused to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1999, Bush's father, President George Bush, imposed a moratorium on underground nuclear testing in 1992. The moratorium was upheld by President Bill Clinton. The idea to resume testing for the first time in 10 years will be raised today when the administration lays out its broad strategic nuclear plans to Congress. The New York Times is reporting that the Bush administration is considering what would amount to the biggest rollback in the Clean Air Act since its passage 30 years ago. If allowed to go forward, power plants will no longer be required to upgrade pollution control equipment when they upgrade their operations. Such a move has long been pushed by energy and industry groups, many of whom have been big supporters of President Bush. However, it's being protested by environmental groups as well as the attorneys general from some states in the Northeast, which often bear the brunt of pollution from industrial plants in the Midwest. convicted Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry Nichols lost another appeal before the Supreme Court yesterday, clearing the way for a state trial on murder charges that could lead to a death sentence. Nichols was convicted in federal court in 1997 of conspiracy and involuntary manslaughter for the deaths of 8 federal agents. The jury sentenced him to life in prison. Nichols was acquitted, however, of the most serious charges in the 1995 bombing, which could have brought the same federal death sentence handed to bombing mastermind Timothy McVeigh. McVeigh was executed last June. And finally, federal health officials said yesterday that of the 10,000 people who may have been exposed to anthrax during the recent attacks, fewer than 2% have taken the anthrax vaccine, a figure that reflects postal employees' deep reluctance to enroll in a medical experiments. The postal workers were so unwilling that officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention considered asking them to enroll in a second study to explore their reasons for refusing the vaccine. However, the agency deemed the plan too politically sensitive, and it was dropped.
From the base, deep down, no precision. High crime, treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning afternoon edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen. Supported.
Michael, my dear, don't say this about us.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been saying.
Listener supported. Here on Democracy Now in Exile, Michael Franti. This is the War and Peace Report, and it's day 2 of Democracy Now's return to the airwaves of Pacifica Radio. But the censorship and banning continues. Yesterday, Pacifica station WBAI in New York banned the show from the airwaves, while KPFK General Manager Mark Shubb refused to air the show at its regular peak time, the 9 o'clock slot, when the show has its biggest listening audience. He did air the program at 6 a.m. WPFW in Washington did air Democracy Now, but they began the broadcast up to 10 minutes into the show, and the station censored the last several minutes of the program when I dedicated Democracy Now to the banned and fired of WBAI and to Fidel Rodriguez and his seditious beats program pulled off the air by KPFK General Manager Mark Shubb in the last weeks. So for those of you who were prevented from hearing yesterday, we rededicate this program to our fired and banned colleagues. Right now, we are going to bring you a few of the voices that Pacifica has refused to air over the last few months. After September 11th, we broadcast a daily 2-hour War and Peace Report. While we're sorry Pacifica listeners couldn't hear this, we thank the 100 community radio stations, public access TV stations, and Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, that did broadcast our 2-hour War and Peace Report. We thought today we'd spend the first part of the program bringing you a medley of what Pacifica listeners have missed since September 11th.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
There may be people in other countries who deserve to live as much as those people in the Twin Towers deserve to live.
Today, we hear the speech of radical historian Howard Zinn, speaking Sunday at the University of Vermont before more than 1,000 people.
Medical students take the oath of Hippocrates. You don't know what to do. Something is bad, really bad. You must do something. But the first rule is do no harm. Let's have to start off with that. You do no harm. We are doing great harm.
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now in Exile, the exception to the rulers.
Do
Yeah, I'm concerned with our taking the initiative to speak out, even though a certain blanket of intimidation has been spread across the country. I mean, am I exaggerating? Isn't it intimidating when everybody in high political circles and people in the higher reaches of the media, when they all cry for unity and supporting the president, and where, you know, editors of the New Republic say people may be considered traitors for speaking out. You have Dan Rather, Anchorman. What is he anchored to? He's anchored to the establishment. That's what an anchor man is. And he says on national television, Bush is my president. When he says, get in line, I ask, where? Well, this is strange. Here he is, independent journalism. And the idea of journalism is to be an independent voice, an independent critic, not a handmaiden of government, but yes, somebody who represents the public and who inspects the government and does not immediately say, yeah, we're together. And when the president says get in line, I get in line too. No. That's what happens in a totalitarian state, not in a democracy.
As Bush announced that the U.S. will go to war, many of those who lost loved ones are saying, not in my name. Rita Lazar and Judy Keene both lost loved ones in the World Trade Center attacks. They're raising their voices to call for peace. Rita Lazar joins us from New York.
Others will speak of the history leading up to this horrible event. I don't have the skill or ability to do that. I just want to say something about my brother. You know about his final act. People call him a hero. I don't think he would think of himself that way. A poem he wrote several years ago reflects how he thought about himself. He wrote, I dreamed I died and went to heaven. And when I got there, they asked me what kind of person I had been. And I said, not so good. So they sent me down to hell. And when I got there, they asked me what kind of person I had been. And I said, not so bad. So they sent me back to Earth. That was my kid brother, not so good and not so bad. This country must allow itself to see its own reflection in the mirror of this horror. We cannot continue to think of ourselves as innocents abroad.
Renowned British journalist Robert Fisk was severely beaten by a crowd of people in an Afghan village just 2 days ago, barely escaped with his life. We were able to reach him on the telephone yesterday to tell his story. I began by just asking Robert Fisk how he was feeling.
I'm feeling better. Obviously, at the time, when you see yourself covered in blood, it's a very disturbing experience, also because you realize that here were people who wanted to hurt you and indeed wanted to kill you. You know, it does bring you face to face with the reality of the way people feel when they feel humiliated and oppressed, I suppose is the old socialist word, and the way in which when they feel that their families are being killed, you can see the brute force of a whole people who feel that they're being destroyed by the West, if you like. And obviously, I was, so to speak, the symbol of the West in this incident. And I think, as you know, I wrote in my article in the Independent of London this morning, that if I had been them, if I had been encouraged to fight the Russians with weapons and money from the West, and then ignored, and then endured civil war, and then asked to fight the Taliban and then had my home bombed by the Americans and then lost members of my family. I mean, I would try to beat up any Westerner I came across. I'd try to attack Robert Fisk too. So, you know, it is impossible for me to feel anger against the people who did this. I mean, they shouldn't have done it, but that's not an argument that works in the kind of brutal landscape that we have helped to create out here. So my overall feeling is that, you know, who can possibly blame them for striking back against the terrible things that happened to them?
Robert, can you tell us exactly what happened and when it happened?
Yes, it was Saturday afternoon. I was traveling from the border town of Quetta in Pakistan down towards the frontier post at Chaman, towards a mountain chain that runs parallel with Afghanistan. And at a village called Kila Abdullah, which by great misfortune to us houses many thousands of Afghan refugees, the boiler started to boil over in the car, the radiator, and steam started to come out of the radiator as the car stopped in the middle of the road, in the middle of this crowded village, full, of course, of angry people. Angry, as we learned later, not only because they'd lost many relatives in the Kandahar, which is only about 80 miles away as the crow flies from the village, but also because they'd been outraged by the film of the prisoners who'd in Mazar-e Sharif, most of whom were Pashtuns, as the refugees were in this village. They had seen also the videotape, so we were told later, of the CIA agents, Dave and Mike, interviewing, or rather interrogating, the Muslim man kneeling on the floor with his hands tied behind his back. So obviously when two Westerners, Justin Hugler and myself, suddenly turned up with a broken car in the middle of the village, we became... Well, first of all, actually, we became friends. We went around, people came around the car, we said, Salaam Alaikum, peace be upon you, Alaikum Salaam, and we shook hands, and people gave us a sort of two-handed handshake. And everything was all right for about a minute. The driver went off to get a new, you know, a fresh car, a taxi. The translator stood next to us. And then we decided there was too big a crowd. A lot of the men were bearded. They were not smiling anymore. We moved towards the center of the road, very crowded road, because, you see, we'd blocked the road when the car broke down, so a lot of people, a lot of traffic. The crowd followed us, and as we walked, a little boy sort of snapped his finger against my wrist rather hard. I hoped that it was just, you know, a joke. Then a pebble spun over my shoulder and hit Justin on the shoulder, and we looked at each other, Justin's eyes full of concern, and we realized something was going wrong there. We then found ourselves being jostled, pushed, punched, not very much, but a little bit. And we suddenly saw a bus driver beckoning us to get on his bus. It was heading back to Quetta. Justin made it onto the bus. I put the first step up, boys and young men, grabbed the blue satchel that was around my shoulder, the satchel in which I carry my passport, credit cards, papers, etc., and tried to pull me back. Justin reached out his hand, and I grasped it. But he tried to pull me on. The crowd were pulling me back. And in the end, they did go of his hand. And they were shouting. I don't know what they were shouting. I don't speak Pashto. I can speak Arabic. And then they started really hit me, first of all on the back, then the shoulders, and then I had fists on the face, and then stones sort of bouncing off my shoulders and bouncing off my head. And then two men came up and started to bash me on the face and the head with stones. And very quickly, there was running down my face. A man came up and smashed my glasses into my face. There was blood in my eyes. I couldn't see. I was short-sighted, and then I couldn't see at all. I felt my shirt going wet with blood. My pullover was drenched in it. It began splashing on my shoes and trousers. And I was obviously in a difficult situation, because although there were 60 at the beginning, I thought there were around 100 people by the time I was bleeding. You know, it was like a bloody horse being slaughtered. It sort of attracted people in an animal-like way, which I don't like to think about. And I was then on my own. Justin and I had lost our grip of each other, and I remembered Lebanese always said, if you're in danger, whatever you do, don't do nothing. So the next man, well, actually, he'd already hit me once. There was a man with a stone who wanted to bash it into my face again. So I hit him with my fist, and I just saw out of the corner of my eye, he spat his tooth out. In fact, on my right wrist now, I've got a big scar from the tooth which I knocked out. And then I went for three other people. I missed one and hit two others and started running. And just for a moment, the crowd held back because, you know, the dying creature, so to speak, had suddenly come alive again, and that was obviously what I intended. And then I ran down the road, and at one point a figure came out. I was standing in the road, the glasses had gone, they'd ripped off my spare pair. I'd actually, unfortunately, also I later discovered, taken my contacts book away with 25 years of names and telephone numbers around the Middle East that had dropped out of my bag when they were trying to seize it. And I was trying desperately with my fingers to push the blood out of my eyes, and I saw this figure come that took me very gently by the right arm, man in robe with a kind of turban and a beard. I didn't really see his face. I didn't concentrate. I kept saying, help me, salam alaikum, peace be upon you. And I think he was some kind of religious person, a cleric, a mullah, perhaps, a Muslim, of course. And as he led me away, the crowd sort of paused, and they sent stones after me, but skittering along the road, not at me, in case they hit the man. So he must have been important in the village. And he put me on board a little police truck we found, and they were too terrified to move. And I was on the truck. I climbed up towards the back of the cab with a little window, and I kept banging on it, saying, help me. And I remember my blood was sort of streaming down the window behind them, and they drove about 15 meters forward. Then the religious man came back and obviously told them to help me more, and they then drove about 300 meters. And there, like a miracle, incredibly, was a Red Cross, Red Crescent convoy.
Reporter Robert Fisk speaking after he was beaten up in Afghanistan. You are listening to excerpts of the War and Peace Report over the last months. We'll be back with more in a minute. We go to break with Patti Smith.
Bright and fair, and my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near, in the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is showered. It's decreed that people rule. All people have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power.
We're going to go to Israel right now. We're joined by someone in the Dehesha refugee camp just outside Bethlehem. In our studio, Ziad Abbas is with us, founder of the Dehesha refugee youth camp. Ziad Abbas, can you tell us the latest news you have out of Bethlehem?
The last news is 1 hour ago that the Israeli army killed two Palestinians in Bethlehem area. And still the clashes continue there in Bethlehem. They are still shelling the city, and especially they concentrate in the two refugee camps, Azza camp and Aida camp. Around 7,000 persons living in these two refugee camps, and it's already surrounded by the Israeli army, and some of the soldiers, they occupied the roofs of the houses, and they are shooting anything moving inside the camp. Some families, since 1 week, they are stuck in their houses. They cannot leave the houses. They don't have enough food. They don't have enough water. And, of course, no electricity, because all the time the Israeli army, when they start attack, they attack the generators of the electricity in the Bethlehem city in general. At the same time, Beit Jala city face the same problem, because the tanks is still there since 1 week now, and they're still searching in the houses, destroyed everything in the houses. And we don't know how many persons they were arrested. But the situation in Bethlehem, which today that you spoke about the massacre in Beit Rima, but I can see there is a massacre in Bethlehem since 1 week, but they do it slowly. And I believe if Sharon will continue that, it will be a big massacre in Dehesha refugee camp.
We are joined by Manar Farag in the Dehesha refugee camp. Can you tell us the scene on the ground right now?
About the situation here, I can't explain it well because there are no words to explain this hard happen. But I can say they are killing us every day and every place in Palestine. We are in the jail. We can't breathe. We can't sleep. Our life, it is a miserable life. The children, they don't know about bomb. They don't know about music or any place to play. They know if this bomb or this voice for M16 or F16 or it is a big bomb. But we are not afraid from them. And I say this because I mean it, not like the political people who are always speak, and there is nothing new or good from them. I hate the politics. I'm just to speak about the reality here. And the reality, it is so hard, and it hurts a lot. And it say, I speak with you today, but I don't know, maybe now, or after I speak, or after I finish with you, bomb come here and kill me. But we love the death if it is for the God and for Palestine.
You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. We're standing at a rally right near the White House. Thousands of people are here calling for President Bush not to respond to the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon in a like fashion. What's your name? And
James McKinney, retired United States Army. Mm-hmm.
When were you in the Army?
What's that?
When were you in the Army?
I was in the Army 65 to 68. And then I got drafted. I was drafted then, and then I retired, and I re-entered the service. I spent 18 years in the National Guard. Yeah.
So you were in Vietnam?
I was in Vietnam, right.
Why are you here at the anti-war rally?
Well, I just want to voice my opinion on it. You know, I went through Vietnam, and they talk about terror. That was a war of terror. So we went to 10 years of that, and now to hear this president say we're going to go back and start this to fight terror, and the war is going to, instead of saying, well, I'm going to get it over with and finish it, it's going to be over a period of time. And I said to myself, I went to Vietnam for 10 years with this thing, and you're going to talk about doing the same thing all over again? And Vietnam was Vietnam. Now you're talking about the whole world? So, you know, it's just that aspect of mine upsetting me. People have not learned about, you know, what people have gone through. When you mention war to a Vietnam soldier, he cringes and runs under the table because he don't want to hear about it. These people don't know what in the world it's all about. When I say people, that is your people in power and your power structure. And it's really a shame.
We see the issues of peace as being very much linked to the issues of social justice and economic justice. That as long as we have a world where there is such gaps between the rich and the poor, where power and wealth is being consolidated into fewer and fewer hands, we're going to have increasing violence.
Reverend Lucius Walker, can you talk about why you came out today?
I came because it's a time to break the silence and break the call for war, which is gripping the country right now. Those of us who understand that terrorism did not begin on the 11th of September, that terrorism is not the exclusive, you know, tactic of people from any other section of the world, but it is primarily a homegrown phenomenon. It's primarily from the U.S. need to speak out.
We're joined by Haider Rizvi, who is a UN reporter here in New York and freelance journalist of Pakistani descent. You were beat unconscious in the last week?
Last week, Saturday.
What happened? Where were you?
At 3 o'clock, I was a few blocks away from my home and wanted to buy cigarettes from a grocery store which is owned by a Pakistani, which is just a coincidence. And there were three unknown people outside the grocery store. And they looked at me and said, "You look like Osama bin Laden. Are you from Pakistan?" I said, "Originally, yes. I wanted to say I'm from Brooklyn. I'm a Brooklynite now." They didn't let me go there. Started beating with kicks and punches. And broke my tooth.
Did anyone come out to help you?
After they had left me unconscious, the grocery store worker came out, brought me.
And got an ambulance?
Got an ambulance.
It's been over a week, and you've been going sort of up and down and suffering as a result of this. You've been doing a lot of reporting on the war.
That's true.
So what do you make of this?
War and the anti-war demonstrations taking place in New York City, which the mainstream media somehow did not cover, most of the demonstrations here. The first demonstration that took place after this September 11 attack in Brooklyn, there were thousands of people. But mainstream newspapers did not cover it. They are not even covering the anti-war demonstrations taking place in London, in Frankfurt, all over Europe.
In the 6 weeks since the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the mainstream media has flooded the airwaves and newspapers with glib commentary about the nature of Islam. We now turn to Faridi Saq. He's a Muslim scholar who's lived the diversity of Islam from Pakistan to South Africa and developed what many call an Islamic theology of liberation, joining us in our Firehouse studio. Can you talk about how you, as a Muslim and a scholar of Islam, explain the attacks and the deeply conservative variant of Islam practiced by the Taliban and others in the region?
I think that it is part of a fundamentalist mindset, a mindset that in the case of the Afghans, it's also a combination of tribalism and a mythical sense that religion provides you with a sense of rootedness and essence, a stability, absolute truths in the face of whether it is the vicissitudes of time, of war on the one hand, or of modernity on the other. But I dare say that it is not a mindset that is peculiar to the Taliban or to Muslims. It's a mindset that at its raw manifestations you see in the Jerry Falwells, you see it in the Pat Robinsons, and I dare say you also see it in the discourse of your president. This whole caricaturing of absolute rightness, absolute goodness on the one side and absolute evil on the other side. I mean, really, this is the shades of the same coin. But you didn't ask me about your president. You asked me about Islam. And the reality is that that there are many strands in Islam, as Edward Said says. I, for example, have spent much of my life working against all forms of religious fundamentalism. I don't like the term moderate. I'm not a moderate. I'm a radical Muslim. I am bitterly opposed to all forms of religious obscurantism. I hate all forms of discrimination, whether it is against transvestites or transgendered people or gay or homosexual people or women or black people. And I've spent my life opposing all forms of discrimination. I don't like the equation of an Islam that stands for justice with a wishy-washy Islam that doesn't take positions.
Will you continue to speak out against the bombing?
Absolutely. I think that not because we're going to succeed. You know, Amy, in the years of struggle against apartheid, we didn't fight that battle because we knew we were going to win. We had no idea we would see a non-racial and a non-sexist South Africa in our lifetime. But we fought because our integrity was at stake. And so we're speaking against the war, not because anybody is going to listen, but we're speaking against the war for us to retain our faith in ourselves as human beings.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
And that was a mix that was put together by Jackie Suin, our webmeister, of some of the voices of the last 2 months of the War and Peace Report. And we're joined right now by two women who have been on our program during those 2 months and are back with us today and are meeting for the first time, from one ground zero to another, from New York to Afghanistan. A New Yorker who lost her brother in the World Trade Center attacks, and an Afghan-American woman who lost 19 members of her family in the U.S. bombing. We're joined by Masuda Sultan, a woman who's just returned from her journey to native Afghanistan, where she met with her family members. And we're going to begin with the report you did for us just a week ago when you were on that road, that dusty road from Pakistan into Afghanistan, and you had just met with members of your family who had survived the U.S. bombing.
We went over there last night. I had heard that there was some devastation. I have some cousins that live in Kandahar, and the extended family is about 55 people. They lived right near some Taliban controlled compounds and buildings, and they anticipated that once the U.S. bombing campaign started, they wouldn't be safe any longer where they were. They decided to move out to some farmland they had about 50 miles outside of Kandahar City, and were staying there in order to stay safe. One evening at about midnight, while they were sleeping, they heard some loud noises outside and realized that their area was being bombed. Some rockets hit nearby, and they decided they had to leave their rooms. As they were running outside of their rooms, some of them were wounded by rockets. Some of them were being shot at. They described the scene where they were running with their kit in their arms, dodging bullets left and right while they saw balls of fire falling down to the earth. They had no idea what was going on, and they were just running in any which direction for their lives. Some of them hid under an area that was covered, and some of them heard word of their loved ones falling to the ground as they were...
We're talking to Masuda Sultan, who's describing how her family members were killed by the U.S. bombs that fell on the farmhouse they were taking refuge in outside of Kandahar. She's speaking to us from Afghanistan.
There were some women and children running for their lives, being shot at by a helicopter hovering over their homes. And these people were not Taliban supporters. They weren't Al-Qaeda fighters. They were simple Afghans trying to stay safe in their own country. The events of September 11th really made me angry, but seeing these people and what they went through make me angry as well. You know, they say that in war, they say that you have to break a couple of eggs in order to make an omelet, but when those eggs are your family, what can you do?
How many members of your family were killed in the bombing?
19 members of that extended family were killed. There were many women and children in that 19, and we were shown some of the pictures as well, and we met the children that became orphans or that lost their mothers. One of them was a little girl that was a year and a half old, and she had been drinking breast milk, and they were having trouble with her getting used to the powdered milk. But it's just, when you see the faces of those little children and they tell you the story of how their mother died on their lap with the blood flowing out of their head, and they ran for their lives, it breaks your heart. It breaks your heart to know that this is the collateral damage of war.
Masuda Sultan, on tape when she reported to us last week after meeting with her surviving family members who had taken refuge in Pakistan, from Afghanistan after 19 members of her family were killed by U.S. bombs. We're going to break for a moment, and when we come back, Masuda Soltan is with us in our Firehouse studio from the second Ground Zero, Afghanistan, and we'll also be joined by Rita Lazar, whose brother Abe died in the World Trade Center attack. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Machine Morley here on the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from our Firehouse studio, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. From the first Ground Zero, the World Trade Center, we're joined by Rita Lazar. She lost her brother on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center, and Masuda Soltan, who is an Afghan New Yorker who just came back from Afghanistan, and you heard her report after she met her family. It is the first time these two women are meeting, and we welcome you both to the War and Peace Report. Rita Lazar, tell us what happened to your brother, Abe.
I was listening to the radio, and the newscaster broke in to say that a plane had hit one of the World Trade Center buildings, and I thought, gee, what an accident. And I live on the 15th floor and ran to my neighbor's house, and she has a clear view of downtown Manhattan, and I looked out her window and saw the second plane hit the second building. And it dawned on me, my brother works there. My brother's in that building. And I sort of went crazy. And then I went about the day doing what all those other people did, calling every hospital, trying to find out if he had been brought to a hospital. I went down to the hospitals to see if his name was on a list. And then I realized he had died. And because he had stayed behind to stay with his quadriplegic brother, I'm sorry, friend, who couldn't get out, although he was on the 27th floor and he could have saved himself, he died.
How do you know that? How do you know that
story?
He
was on the phone with my other brother and my sister-in-law, and he said, don't worry, we're waiting for the firemen to come, and as soon as they come, they're going to help Ed and me get out of here. Ed was in a wheelchair and could not move. But by the time the firemen came, the building collapsed, and it was too late. And then President Bush mentioned him in the National Cathedral speech and cited him as being a hero. And I realized that my government was going to use my brother as justification for killing other people. And that had a tremendous impact on me. I didn't want that to happen, not in my brother's name. And so I wrote a letter to the Times, which they printed, asking our government to please be cautious and not do something they couldn't take back. And then I was asked to speak at a peace rally, and I did it. And just before I went on, I was told they had started bombing Afghanistan. And I realized something I had never realized before. I'd heard the term collateral damage all my life. It was always used about people far away from us. And I realized now what it meant, because my brother was collateral damage in a war that he didn't want and Masuda's people didn't want. And I knew I had to do something, but I didn't know what. And then I got a call from this wonderful woman from this marvelous organization called Global Exchange. And she said, would you like to go to Afghanistan and meet people like you who have lost their families? And I thought, that's perfect, because Masuda and I are the same. There's no difference between us. My family member died. I'm grieving. And her family, God, I don't know how you survive just hearing about yours. But we're the same people. And so I'm going to Afghanistan. I'm going to see the people who have been left behind while their families died, with three other people who have lost family members, either in the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, or the Pentagon, or the World Trade Center. And we're going to come back here, and we're going to try to get the American public to open its heart and its wallet for your people the way they have done for us, and try to get our government to understand that bombing is not the solution.
Masuda, you've never met Rita Lassar before. You've just come back from Afghanistan, where Rita is headed to right now. You've had a week of reflection, and you've come back, well, to Ground Zero. You left from Ground Zero, and you've come back. What are your thoughts now? And if you could talk about how it was for you to meet with your family members.
First of all, I want to express my condolences to Rita. I did before, but I think your brother is a hero, and you're a hero for continuing his legacy. And it's amazing to me that someone who's lost so much isn't as revenge hungry as some of the other people that seem to want to, you know, go start bombing, you know, whoever, wherever, you know. A lot of this is about revenge, I feel, because especially having seen the faces of the people there and realizing that these are the farthest things from the enemy that, you know, we could find. Granted, the American bombing campaign has been, I think, even with the death toll in my extended family and some of the other cases, I don't think that the U.S. government intended to bomb, you know, to carpet bomb the area. But I'm still trying to figure out what's going on. On the one hand, I think the United States government didn't intend to do some of this. On the other hand, I can't believe they did it, and who would make such a stupid mistake? To be honest, I'm still a little confused about things.
Your family left an area in Kandahar, where you come from, and actually took refuge in a farmhouse so that they would not be bombed.
It's the irony is the saddest part of all of this. In Kandahar, they lived right next to Taliban-controlled buildings, and they knew, they anticipated that the United States was going to bomb those types of areas. So they left the city and fled to really a desert. We took that same trip, and it was about an hour and a half to 2 hours outside of the city of Kandahar. And it was literally the middle of nowhere. We actually got lost getting out, and it took us about 3 hours to find our way back to the main road. The irony is that they left that area thinking they would be safe in this desert because there's no Taliban there. And ironically, that's where they were hit.
When you went to the Marine base in Kandahar and asked them why they bombed your family, what was the response?
The Marine that I spoke to told me that they hadn't, that that particular group, the Marines, had only been in Kandahar Airport after the incident, so he didn't have information for me. He told me that I should speak to the State Department. Privately, some of the Marines did express their condolences. And what shocked me was what I sensed coming from them was a sort of confusion about why they were there. I asked one of them why they were in Kandahar, I think, which is a valid question. Why are you willing to risk your life here? And he said, we're here to oust the Taliban. And I looked at him and said, but the Taliban have been in power since 1996. Is that, do you feel comfortable being here to oust the Taliban? Doesn't it sound kind of odd? And he really couldn't answer my question. And I could sense the discomfort he felt. And it's scary that there are people that will fight, in the name of something they don't really understand. I love the United States. I grew up here. I came here at the age of 5, and I feel, as American as anyone else. But and I would fight for my country gladly. But I don't know if the mission is really clear and if the intent is honorable.
Masuda, after the World Trade Center attacks and occurred on September 11th, and then all of the information or non-information started to come out, and it became clear that the U.S. was making Afghanistan a target, what were your feelings at the time?
When September 11th happened, and I watched those buildings collapse, and I thought about all those people in there, like Rita's brother, I was angry. I was angry just as any New Yorker. And my immediate feeling was, who are the jerks that did this and what are we going to do about it? And I went down there that first week and actually got through some police barricades and watched what was going on and, volunteered for a few hours. But my immediate reaction was anger and shock. But that same day, I sensed that something like this was not going to go unpunished. I mean, I would want to figure out who did it, too. I realized that Osama was probably in some way responsible and that the United States was probably, going to do something about that. And guess what? Osama's in Afghanistan. And that day, I started making phone calls on September 11th to family here in New York to tell them to also call some family back in Afghanistan to sort of alert people to the fact that this may happen. And some of them didn't think that it would go that far. And they said, oh, you're being too cautious. And as, as time and the events sort of unfolded, that's exactly what happened. And something like this probably shouldn't go unpunished, but who do we punish is really the question, and how do we punish them? And I don't think that what the United States is doing in Afghanistan is really what they set out to do. In the beginning, I was actually hoping that if they got the perpetrators in Afghanistan, that the people of Afghanistan would finally be freed. They were also held hostage by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for the last number of years. They suffered at the hands of these people. And now, again, are suffering at the hands of these people. who have come and essentially, in my view, Al-Qaeda has invaded Afghanistan, has taken control, and is now using it as their war zone. And again, it's sort of what happened when the Soviets invaded, and it was the proxy war. I mean,
and your family members are not alive to enjoy the freedom, if there will be.
Some of them have survived. It was really difficult to. I was asked by a lot of people there, both my family and other people that had lost possessions and people in some of the bombings, what the United States was going to do about it. And I thought about, you know, how September 11th funds were everywhere and how great that was and how much the American people opened their hearts to the victims of September 11th. And then I thought about, and the United States government as well. And then I thought about, what about these people who, you know, for some reason or other got caught in the middle of all of this, lost lives, lost children, you know, lost property. Who do they ask, you know, for help? Who do they turn to?
Well, it seems like Rita Lazar has taken up that banner with a few other people. Unfortunately, your message doesn't get out very much in the mainstream media. The stories of people like your brother, heroes at the World Trade Center, are heard. But when you then take the next step and say, though you do not think that war is the answer, that's not the part of the story that we hear. A New York Times photograph showed people who walked from Washington to New York saying, not in our name. And the photograph just said people who were mourning their loved ones at the World Trade Center and Pentagon.
We're hoping by going to Afghanistan, members who have lost their loved ones, and showing that we understand that the people in Afghanistan, as well as we, are mourning and hurting and are innocent, just as my brother and I are innocent. We're hoping that this will get more coverage than it has. And we're hoping that, just as Masuda said, the September 11th fund was a generous, more than generous, acknowledgement of our loss, that there will be an equal Afghanistan fund from the American people and from our government to help those people. And
we only have a minute, and we have to wrap up the show, but I do want to give each of your contact information. Masuda Sultan has set up an organization called Young Afghan World Alliance. You can go to www.yawa.org. That's yawa.org. And, of course, Rita Lazar, who is going now to Afghanistan, is going with Global Exchange, and that website is globalexchange.org.
And their 800 number is 800-497-1994.
We've run out of time on today's program, but this dialogue will certainly continue in the weeks to come. Unfortunately, today's show was not heard at 9 on Pacifica Station WBAI as it continues its policy of censorship, banning, and firing. We thank, though, the thousands of listeners who have called and written to us over the last few days. It was you who got Democracy Now! Back on Pacifica Airwaves, and it'll be you who gets the program back at its regular times throughout the network. This is your network. We are Pacifica. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.